Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. This episode was recorded on Monday, October 24th, 2016, starting just after, starting right at 3:22 p.m. in Denver, Colorado, and this is the 92nd episode of the show. For more information about how to subscribe to the podcast and help support the production of future episodes by becoming a patron, please visit theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe. In this episode, I'm going to be talking with Kelly Surtees and Austin Coppock about the astrological forecast for the month of November 2016, as well as looking at some auspicious dates from the vantage point of electional astrology. Kelly and Austin, welcome back to the show.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having us.
Hey, so this is our first episode since ESAR. We got to spend a whole week together almost, I guess, just last week for the first time, I guess, in what, like a year and a half?
I think it's been like 2 years. It would have been when we were all at NORWAC together.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, so a year and
maybe
a half.
Maybe 18 then. Months.
Crazy. Okay, well, we had a great time. We got to spend, not as much time as we'd like, but we got to have some great conversations, I think, at different points throughout the week. Yeah.
Totally. Yes.
Yeah, it was really nice.
So good to be together in person.
Yeah, so what was you guys' overall sort of experience of the conference? I mean, I had a pretty great time overall. I think that was the general sense that most people had, right?
I think so. I loved it, but I'm a bit of a junkie for that kind of time together. I did so much because I did come in early to participate in the ESAR consulting skills and ethics training before the conference, which I found to be really useful. But seeing everyone, seeing you guys, one of the funniest things, you know, was to meet podcast listeners who, you know, when you get introduced in person and you speak, and so many people would say, your voice sounds really familiar. And then they'd be like, they'd pause for a minute and then they go, oh, you did that show with Chris. I'm like, yes. So that was really lovely. Apparently we've gone on car rides with people. We've done, you know, housework with other people. So it was fun to see everyone. The biggest thing I love about conferences is, sorry, Chris?
Scuba diving, skydiving, many places.
Many things. We've been all over. You know, and the biggest thing that I love about conferences is, you know, people are voices or presences, you know, that you connect with through social media or online. And when you're at a conference, it's like the energy of that person is made manifest into a real body. And that's really special to be able to spend time with people, you know, in the flesh.
Yeah, it was crazy just how many, because there's something like I think ESAR said at the end that there was something like 500 people there, including the speakers.
Yes.
And it was just crazy how many people we met that had listened to the podcast, and it just kind of blew me away.
Yeah, you're doing a good job, Chris. And that's probably why you won that big award that we have to mention too.
Right. So on the, what was it, like the fourth or fifth night of the conference, they held a banquet. And they gave out two awards. One of them was for the best journal article that had been published in the ESAR Journal over the past 2 years. And the other was a new award for best audiovisual production. And the ESAR membership gave us an award for the podcast, which was crazy and great.
Yeah, it's legit too. There you have a shiny plaque, I believe.
Totes. Yep.
Right. I have a shiny plaque. Once we do another video episode, I'll have to get it hung in the background. And now I get to say, you know, literally an award-winning podcast.
Well deserved, Chris. You put a lot of time and effort and energy into making sure the podcast is the quality that it is. So I think it's well deserved.
Yeah. And it's nice to see people reacting to something that's of good quality and not just pandering to the lowest common denominator. I think we all know that astrology has that problem where only sort of the most salacious fourth grade reading level stuff, you know, gets popular. And so it's really nice, you know, it's really nice that you've been putting out something that, you know, has an appeal to people who've been studying the art for a while or even a very long time, but not alienating to beginners. You know, you're speaking to a number of audiences simultaneously. And so it makes me happy that I'm not the only one who likes it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and it's been really wild, especially it's been great over the past year, just building this up with you and Kelly. And I think that's been the biggest thing in terms of expanding our audience and keeping up the quality of the show and developing a sort of consistent listenership is just having this reoccurring, you know, feature each month where we come in and check in with everybody month after month and do our thing. So, so thanks everyone who listens for voting for the podcast. That was really awesome. And thanks to everybody who came up to us at the conference and just sort of expressed that they enjoy the show or that they listen to the show or what have you.
Super exciting.
Yeah. So what were some of the other, I mean, I guess this is basically a recap. So what were some of the other highlights? I mean, Kelly, you did the ethics and counseling training at the very beginning.
Yeah, and I'm happy if I can just mention that for a minute. Long story short, I do have a background in counseling, which I did years ago. And over my years teaching other student astrologers, I've really noticed that to be a good consulting astrologer, if that's the direction you want to go in with your astrology, and you don't have to because there's many ways that you can use astrology or share astrology. But if you want to go down that consulting, client consulting route, having some good communication skills is critical to how well you'll be able to build a practice and how rich and helpful you'll be able to make your consults. And I was just almost blown away by the quality of the training that they offer. It's just about basic communication skills, but when you work with people on a one-on-one basis, there's a level of intimacy that is created between the astrologer and the client. And knowing how to effectively communicate is equally important as knowing good astrology if you want to be really useful and helpful for your client. So I really can't speak highly enough about that particular part of my time in California with the ESAR conference. The training was, you know, part of the reason I'm doing it is that we've got a view. I'm the new ESAR VP for Eastern Canada. And over the next couple of years, ESAR is looking to do some of these trainings in and around Toronto, which I'll be assisting with. So it was great to just experience the training and get a feel for it. But if you are wanting to go in the consulting direction, I would highly recommend getting involved with this program. It's 2.5 days and you do it usually before a conference. I think the next one that's pre-conference will be before UAC, but they do offer trainings in different areas, you know, globally. And it's just really effective, simple communication skills that you can incorporate into your astrology that will honestly will blow you away with how effective they can be. So it was very good.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I'm glad we have things like that that are happening in the community or being offered like that, just because astrologers, you know, the normal route is just at some point, you know, if somebody wants to start reading charts or doing it professionally, they just start doing it at some point, usually with like friends and family or something like that. But then eventually with clients, oftentimes not charging very much, but then it just becomes this sort of process of, sort of learning as they go. And it makes a big difference in terms of, learning some of those skills in terms of counseling that you might not get otherwise. And that's actually one of the, I don't know if you want to say problems, but it's one of the issues just with that is that sometimes astrologers, you know, then get into reading charts and doing it professionally without ever getting any of that training in terms of what being a good counselor is like, or some of the things you should be aware of as counseling techniques or things that you should be careful about without that training. So it's good that that's being offered now in different places.
Absolutely. I think it's something you want to take advantage of if that's what you're interested in, for sure.
Sure. Okay. And then let's see what else. So you did that as a pre-conference thing, and then did you get your lectures out of the, you guys? When did you do your lecture, Kelly?
I did it on Saturday morning around 11:15. So it was kind of nice to get it out of the way before the Saturday night party, which was good. Saturday's a nice time to present.
Yeah, that's like right towards the middle of the conference, it seems like. So that's a pretty good place. Mine was at like the very end, which is always annoying just in terms of having to wait until the very end of the conference before you can, you know, be done with the hard part or be done with the actual work.
True. But, you know, sometimes they do put, you know, you've got a fairly high profile these days, Chris, and sometimes they do put people like yourself on the last day just to keep everyone excited towards the end.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's usually pretty random in terms of where you do get placed, but just one of those funny things that you don't think about until you get there. If you are a presenter, where sometimes you randomly get placed right at the front and you sort of, you know, get it out of the way right away, and then you sort of relax for the rest of the conference. And other times there's this sort of build up until you eventually give your talk at the end. So it's kind of a random thing that you don't think about until you're actually there.
Totally.
Austin, you helped to organize a number of like free speech lectures for AYA people, it seemed like, right? Or at least you were involved in picking
some. Yeah. ESAR has been a great friend to the Association for Young Astrologers the last several years, or at least the several years that I've been president of the AYA. I can't speak to your tenure, but they reached out to us and offered 6 of the lunch speech slots. And so I helped find and coordinate a number of speakers. Got to see some baby birds fly for the first time. In particular, your very own Patrick Watson. That was his first speech at a conference. He was well overdue. There are a number of other good speeches as well. And just in terms of the AYA, that was actually, it was actually at the conference that I officially made public my resignation as the president. I'm succeeded by Aliyah Wessela, in whose capable hands the AYA will continue.
That's awesome. So there was an actual, I guess we didn't get to have like an actual handing over ceremony, but there was definitely a sort of passing of the guard at this conference, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, there were, I don't want to talk smack about the ESAR conference because I really enjoyed 90% of it, but there was an event on Friday night, whose idea I think, was not equal to its execution. The hotel had some rules that were imposed on the org crawl that I think made it a little bit less, joyous. and bacchanalian than it was originally envisioned to be. So we'd originally kind of thought that would provide a party context where we could yell at a bunch of people to be quiet for a second, but it didn't quite work out. But I think we all survived, and we introduced Aliyah to a great number of people. I only regret that I wasn't able to purchase a little Halloween crown to hand over.
Right.
Obviously, I lost the crown that you gave me some years ago.
Yeah, there was. I remember we actually did have like a handing over ceremony. We have a nice picture from it at UAC 2012 in Michael Luton's suite, where there was a party one night, and we actually, you know, announced that you were now the president. So it seemed like a nice literal sort of handing over sort of moment back then. 4 years. I can't believe it's been four and a half years since that time that you've been running the organization.
I can.
You can.
Yes. Heavy is the head. But so we might have to do an unofficial one or another, a delayed official one at the next big conference where it's like, well, Leah's been president for a year and a half now, but here's a party and here's a crown.
Right. Yeah, and she gave a talk, actually, that
she
was
did.
Excellent.
Yeah, she has a background in social work. And so she gave a really interesting talk about, and I think this is of general interest to astrologers. She gave this really interesting talk about how the quality of resilience can be seen or aided by astrology. You know, resilience is something that's really fascinating to people who work in psychology or social work. Because resilient people are the people who come from, you know, the tough environment, the bad town, the rough family or whatever, and yet somehow end up being amazing, right? It's this sort of X factor. Aliyah's talk was looking at how can astrology help people become more resilient, you know, to respond to change in positive ways. And to, you know, how do you embody that Nietzschean maxim of, you know, what does not kill you makes you stronger? Cause that's true sometimes, but a lot of times what does not kill you just kind of hurts and sucks. Right. And so, you know, that X factor is resilience. She gave a really interesting talk on trying to look at that through an astrological lens and asking whether astrology was actually an art and a practice that could help build or fortify our resilience, our ability to change.
It was a really thought-provoking presentation that she gave.
Yeah, it was really, really good. There's actually a lot of good free speech. I mean, her free speech lecture was great. Alexander Zolotov gave one, and he actually got that together at like the last minute, right? Because he was a
like 1 week out replacement for Nick Civitello, who couldn't make it.
Wow.
And that was really interesting because he was raising this question of like, why is there this repetition in the Chaldean ordered Deccans system from the Hellenistic period that became like the main system of Deccans and the essential dignities in the medieval period? Why does it have that weird repetition where it sort of starts with Mars ruling the first Deccan of Aries, and then it ends with Mars ruling the first Deccan of Aries? Last Deccan of Pisces. And that led to this sort of, he sort of drew out this sort of group conversation to try to work through this as like an issue. And it ended up resulting in a lot of really interesting sort of observations during the course of that lecture.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something I've thought about for a long time. I don't have an answer to, but it's something that was odd because there's no repetition of planetary rulers anywhere else in that system of assigning planets to Deccans. And so it was very obviously a choice. And so trying to figure out the rationale behind that choice is an interesting exercise. Maybe we'll actually figure it out at some point.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that he pointed out that I saw, I mean, he pointed out we needed to be looking at it from the perspective of Cancer rising from the Thema Mundi. And one of the things that happened for me in that lecture that I noticed when he did that was really interesting was just, if you use Firmicus Maternus's version of the Thema Mundi that has 15 degrees of Cancer rising, then in that Deccan system, it put Mercury as the Deccan, the rising Deccan, according to that system that was on the ascendant.
Mm-hmm.
And the first place, the first house, of course, is the house that's associated with Mercury in the Hellenistic tradition. But then what was weird is the other three planets that were on the degrees of the other three angles were all planets that had their exaltation in those specific signs. So the sun rules the second decan of Aries, and that would have been on the degree of the midheaven. The descendant was like Mars ruling, what was it? It was like the middle decan.
Yep, middle cap.
Capricorn, so and Capricorn Mars is its exaltation. And then finally, at the IC, we had Saturn's decan in the middle of Libra, and Libra, of course, is the exaltation of Saturn. And I thought that was a really interesting and weird coincidence that I wondered if that wasn't deliberate somehow.
Yeah. And, you know, there's been some academic Egyptological research where there's at least one researcher who thinks that there's a case to be made for some Egyptian input into the exaltations of the planets. And that's not widely accepted at this point. But that is out there, and that might be one piece which points towards that, or perhaps points towards a much earlier intersection of the Babylonian and Egyptian systems of sky lore.
Sure. Okay. So, so there was a lot of great free speech talks. There was a lot of great, you know, non-free speech talks. Kelly, you gave yours on Saturday. I gave mine on Sunday, eventually on Zodiacal Releasing, of which I'm selling the recording of now through my website. Are you selling your recording as well, Kelly, or you already have other talks like that up?
I will be selling the recording from ESA, but I did just actually load up my two lectures from the NORWAC conference earlier this year. I spoke on Fidaria in one talk and the 11th house, of good spirit, why the 11th house is kind of a lucky house potentially and how you can work with it. That was another talk from NORWAC. So yeah, I've just put those lectures up on my website for sale.
Okay, awesome. I'll put links to those in the description page for this episode. Other That's things.
I was just going to say, Kelly, I didn't even know you work with Fidaria. You're such a like secret librarian of techniques.
I know. I think Chris mentioned something like that when I spoke on temperament at ESA 2014. He was like, I didn't even know you used that. I was like, oh yeah. I don't know. I was really lucky early in my astrological career to get a good introduction to quite a lot of these other techniques, I guess. And I love them. So yeah.
Yeah. I'd say you're just so friendly and approachable that people, people don't know to look for the fearsome brain.
That's so sweet. Thank you.
Put that on a book cover or something. So what else? I mean, and then Patrick, I talked about in the last episode, you know, ended up in that being quoted in the Washington Post and like the title of the Washington Post very early in the week, which was wild. And that sort of leads into the final presidential panel, which was sort of, for me, sort of like the culmination of the conference, just in terms of that being the final event that the conference kind of ended with, which I talked about with Patrick a little bit, but he actually had to go home early and wasn't in the audience, so we didn't get into it that much. But you guys were actually there in the audience for the final presidential panel, right?
Right. I had that like giant foam finger that said, "Go, Chris." That was right. Me.
I did see you in the back, with that, with like a contingent of other astrologers that we knew.
Yeah, the bad kids.
Yeah, we're in the back row bandits.
So, yeah, I mean, I was up on the stage, but what did you guys think of the final panel?
I would have liked to have seen everyone have a little bit more time to explain how they got to their conclusions. There was a lot of technique happening, but it was almost like it was sort of jump cut, like an 80s music video or a 90s music video. And so it would be like, and here's 17 charts, and yeah, Clinton's going to win.
Right. Know? I mean, that's literally what we all had to say, because and that there would have been more of that, but they cut all of our time in half at the last minute so that everything we had prepared, we sort of had to throw out the window and just say, you know, we're using this, and this chart, and Clinton will win, and that's the end, basically.
Yeah, honestly, I would have rather you either had less time or more time. Like, if you just said, I use this technique, this is what I think, you know, just one sentence answer, that I would have been okay with that. Or if you had time to really get into where you were drawing your conclusions from, I would have been into that too. But I feel like it was sort of a middle ground that didn't work, that didn't quite satisfy the need for brevity or depth.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and then, you know, I did my 4 minutes at the beginning, but then I literally didn't say anything else for the rest of the panel until the very end. And there was a lot of what seemed like to me, like a lot of like wild predictions starting to be thrown about. In what started with, you know, a little comment on the first panel that somebody made about Inauguration Day not happening, possibly due to some aspect that I don't even remember what it was. And then somehow that became like the focal point of discussion on the second panel, where the moderator kept bringing it back to that topic, it seemed like, for a while. And people started, both on the panel as well as in the audience, because it became a sort of free for all where for some reason there was a microphone going around the audience, and then different people were throwing in different additional sort of related statements in connection with that.
Yeah. To me, this brought up a couple issues. One, the conversation, I think, especially towards the end, became something that was reminded me of like sitting around and having a few drinks with astrologers and just kind of speculating, just being like, well, dude, have you seen that chart? That chart's crazy. And I've totally done that in private with, but we've all done that, right? But like, dude, right. Have you seen, you know, March 17th of 2020? Like, that shit's crazy. So I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with that kind of discussion. Good stuff comes out of that. But I felt like the degree of publicity, which that presidential panel had, provided a context that was maybe not super useful for that discussion. You know, I don't know what got reported and whatnot, but there was press, at those presidential panels. The sometimes wild speculation that you have to go through to kind of get down to what what your prediction will be, is maybe not something that's useful, to be available to be reported on. That's my opinion, at least at this point in time. And I think it raises this larger question of how do we do astrology when the world is watching, as opposed to when we're just, you know, when we're just being ignored? Because I think a lot of astrologers are used to being ignored. And, you know, astrology seems to be intersecting more powerfully, both positively and negatively, with mainstream discourses right now. And I don't know whether that's good or bad or other. I think it's both or all three. And that I, you know, it got me thinking that we as a community need to think more about how we act when certain people are watching and recording. And I think that maybe that's something we'll be thinking about. I hope that we'll be thinking about collectively.
Yeah. I mean, that was definitely one of the issues that came up that a lot of people talked about, which was just, there was an attempt to get as much press there for the presidential panels as possible. And that definitely happened for the first one. And a lot of the statements that were made on the first panel then suddenly ended up being, you know, headlines in some newspaper articles or some online articles from like The Guardian and the LA Times and everything else. One of the comments that somebody made to me afterwards was actually that luckily or thankfully the press didn't actually show up to the second panel, because Isar had spent so much time promoting the first one and doing a press conference on the first day that the press seemed to have really sort of gone home by the time of the second panel. And honestly, I think that that was good, because then, sort of like you were saying, Austin, it's like a large part of what ended up happening was sort of almost like an internal conversation that might have been okay amongst a group of friends, or might have been okay within the astrological community, where people are like throwing around different charts and techniques and sort of throwing around speculations about what this might indicate or what have you, you know, something that might be okay or might be, you know, discussed amongst practitioners, instead was like being broadcast to this broader audience. And I don't think it would have made astrologers look particularly good if that did end up getting covered in the same way that the first panel had, just because, like a lot of not great statements that were made. And then there was this like separate side issue of like, you know, what kind of predictions is it appropriate to make in a public setting? And like, would you make the same statements to like a client if there's a client sitting in front of you? Or would that be like terribly unethical to make some of the statements that were made like that to a client in private?
Yeah, absolutely. I also wanted to add that, again, it's one thing to have sort of a conversation in a more insular context, but when you start saying things publicly, you run the risk of accidentally validating political narratives that you don't want flying around. I always think of Alexander Cummins' study of the practice and political use of astrology during the English Civil War. It's a good book. It's called The Starry Rubric. And you see astrologers' statement, either astrologers being sort of drafted into making very strong political statements, using astrology that the astrology may or may not actually bear out. And you see this intersection of astrology and power turning astrology into a tool for propaganda. I don't want to see that happen to astrology. I'd like to see that minimized, as astrology seems to be moving into a period where, you know, the political media power is paying more attention to what astrologers say.
Sure. Yeah. And that issue of astrology for propaganda purposes, or astrology that's being influenced by, you know, it's a recurring issue in the astrological community that at some point is worth talking about, but just, you know, to what extent is the astrology being influenced by the person's sort of political leanings, or to what extent is the discussion being partial and the sort of types of questions that are coming up being partially dictated by a person's political leanings and the type of sort of media narrative that they've themselves adopted or sort of subscribed to, versus how much of this is the actual like astrology talking. And I mean, some of that just becomes relevant sometimes as well on a very basic level of an astrologer cannot generally make a statement or a prediction about something that's outside of the scope of what they think is possible to happen. So almost all astrological predictions always take place within the context of or within the scope of what the astrologer thinks is possible or what possible scenarios they can even imagine themselves. And then they sort of make their statements within the context of that. So there's always like a context for astrological predictions.
That's a really interesting point. To a certain degree, every astrologer's statements reveal their viewpoint on reality and what is real and what can become real and what can't.
Right. And what's within the realm of plausibility and what's something that we should seriously consider as a plausible scenario versus what's something that person is not considering a plausible scenario, or even what's something that the person's just not mentioning because it's not within their field of vision. I mean, that actually becomes an issue when you are talking about, and this came up in the panel, but this is sort of like a side comment, but that comes up with situations like major world events that haven't happened before, or like major catastrophes and stuff, is that sometimes, you know, if it's something that new that hasn't happened before, then sometimes the astrologer might be able to describe it in very broad archetypal terms, but otherwise they might not be very good about explaining the specifics because it's not even something that they themselves can sort of comprehend on a practical level actually happening.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Sure. So, yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm trying to think of if there's anything else related to that we needed to mention. It probably just deserves a whole sort of show on its own. I mean, did you have anything, Kelly, or from your perspective, what was your perspective on all of that?
I mean, it is a bit tricky because I'm not American and I don't vote. So I know that my sort of take, even as an astrologer and comments on predictions and stuff, are very much as an outsider and from someone who's country's political climate is 100 times different to the US. You know, I'm Australian and I live in Canada, and both of those countries run on a parliamentary system rather than a presidential system, which is a system in which you vote for a party to lead your country rather than a person to run your country. And so it's just, I mean, there's subtle and very obvious ways that it's different. So I always watch the American presidential race with a, you know, like, wow, this is just different. The panel itself at the conference, I did enjoy it. I thought some people were really eloquently spoken and were able to give some useful information in the time they had and were very clear. You know, yourself, Chris, Nina Griffin, I love her work on the Aries Ingress chart. I think it's very consistent and she's looked at that, you know, over more than 100 years. Lynn Lehman had some interesting things to say. I can't remember the Vedic astrologer's name, but I thought she was really interesting. And so, you know, those people are examples. It might have been Edith Hathaway. I'm not sure.
It was Joni Paltry.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Joni. Okay. So maybe it was Edith in the Friday panel that I really enjoyed. Was there a different Vedic astrologer?
Yeah,
on the Thursday night? Yeah. Just partly because I'm curious about the Vedic systems, because that's something that's sort of an area of newness for me. But I did think some people were very clear in getting their point across and they seemed to make a prediction that was really well grounded in reality. And then there were a couple of people who seemed to maybe be spinning off into the realm of what I felt personally was slightly implausible. And so that you just sort of take that with a grain of salt, I think.
Sure. Yeah. And that the whole thing about like plausibility or like grounding, it's such a subjective thing. You know, it's difficult in astrology, but it's interesting hearing different people's reactions to different predictions and like different people's feelings about which ones were like more grounded than others or which ones where it was like, it was clear what the logic was. And so you could say, you know, even if you don't use that specific technique or that approach, you sort of like understand that they're drawing it from something specific, whereas some astrologers just had some sort of, sometimes when you read some of the predictions online, for example, you have just sort of this gut feeling that this person is, you know, focusing too much on one specific tiny thing. Like if they're using like an asteroid or something like that, and they're like, the entire election depends on this asteroid, you know, sometimes that looks more like a bit of a stretch, but it's interesting that the line between those is a little bit blurry. And I wish it wasn't so blurry, because it would almost be nice. I've been thinking more about, you know, if I was to put together a panel, like what's the best way to go about doing that? Or how could one improve upon the present model? And one of those things is just making sure everybody's doing really grounded work in whatever tradition they're approaching it from. But figuring out how to not enforce that, but how to encourage that would be kind of tricky.
Well, and you and I, Chris, I believe, had a conversation about maybe looking at track records if you're going to have a panel of experts on something.
Right. Yeah, it's just that's something that wasn't clear to what extent the track records of different people, you know, whatever the selection process was for these panels seemed a little bit random. And while they did actually provide a nice spectrum of different approaches and different types of astrology, I thought in some ways, there was also like a bit of randomness to the selection process. And it wasn't clear that sort of like past track records were necessarily taken into account in terms of like, you know, repeatedly successful predictions over the course of the last few elections or something like that. And it would be, yeah, I mean, part of the problem with that, of course, is that most of the time, predictions aren't even really tracked. So I did a summary of as many predictions as I could find during the last election in 2012, but I was looking around for sort of like previous attempts at that, and I didn't really find any. So one of the issues is just, you know, oftentimes the predictions that people make for big events like this aren't necessarily tracked or collated in a single source. And something like that would probably be useful and probably should be taken into account. Although I remember when we were having a conversation, we got into like a heated conversation about this one night later. And I really remember there was some pushback from somebody about that in terms of, you know, where do you draw the line? Or if somebody does get a prediction wrong, does that mean, you know, they're necessarily going to get this election wrong? Or what were the circumstances underlying their false prediction in the past or whatever? Obviously, there's all sorts of issues surrounding that in terms of if you were to try to impose certain rules or standards. But it seems like, you know, something sort of should be put in place in order to help sort of elevate or put this on a more professional and sort of reliable level, given that that often becomes the main thing every 4 years. Whenever there's a conference that there is a presidential panel about, it usually does get a decent amount of press. And so it would be nice if we were doing our best as a community to make sure that these events went as smoothly and as professionally and as successfully as possible. So, and I guess that's the only reason I sort of talked about it during the last episode, and then we're talking about it a little bit again here and wanting to hear you guys' reactions to it. Okay. So we can leave that there. We don't have to draw any more out. I don't want to get anybody in trouble. And, I think we've probably said enough. So, let's move on to our forecast. Actually, before we do that, so the ESAR conference, I think all of us agree that it was an amazing conference all overall, right?
Totally. Oh, I had a great time. There were so many wonderful and smart people there. We're just nitpicking.
Yeah, we're just nitpicking as like professionals, or in my case, as somebody that like agonizes over specific things like the politics or like the birth data of people like Hillary Clinton or whoever. You know, it's easy to nitpick things. So yeah, overall, it was a great conference. We all had a great time. It was fun hanging out. ESAR gave us all an award for the podcast, which was amazing. And yeah, and I'm looking forward to the next conference, which I should actually mention at this point. The next big conference, it's going to be the biggest conference of the year, is the NCGR conference that's taking place in Baltimore in February. And I think you're going to be at that one as well, right, Kelly?
I am.
Okay, awesome.
So that'll be good. No, Austin, you're not going to be there?
As alluring as Baltimore in February sounds, I don't think I'm going to be able to make it. No, I'm sure it'll be wonderful. The conference will be inside, so the weather is really not going to be an issue. No, but no, I don't think I have time for that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they do take time.
we might be able to change your mind. We might be able to talk you into it in the next few months. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, I'm always open to being convinced.
Peer pressure.
Well, the conference, despite Austin, you're kind of killing my promo here, but
I'm sorry. I couldn't help it.
That's all right. The conference is one of our supporters this month, and we're actually giving away a free pass to the conference to one of the lucky patrons on our $10 tier. So I just wanted to pitch it really quick. It's from February 16th through the 20th, 2017. The title is The Many Faces of Astrology, and the underlying theme of the conference, which I really like, is the diversity of the astrological tradition and the, you know, quote unquote, many faces of astrology. So there's going to be 60 speakers from around the world. There's going to be pre and post conference workshops. There's going to be lunchtime lectures, a banquet, a trade show with lots of astrology books, probably hundreds of astrologers. I'm going to guess at least 300 to 400 astrologers in attendance. Plus many people who have been guests or regular visitors to this podcast will be speaking there, including myself and Kelly and Lisa Scheim, Demetra George, Ian Weisler, Christopher Renstrom, Rick Levine, and many more. So you can find out more information about the conference at ncgrconference2017.com. And we'll be, if you want to enter for a chance to win the free pass to the conference, then you just have to become a patron of the show on the $10 tier. And then we'll do the drawing and announce the winner on episode 94 of the show. Okay, so that's my pitch for that. So Kelly and I will be there, and hopefully we can. I really got to do a live show because I was at that ASAR conference last week, and I wished that I had brought some better. I just need to invest in some better mobile equipment for doing live podcasts. But we'll have to see if I can set something up by February. At the very least for you and I, Kelly, if we can't drag Austin to the East Coast in February.
Yeah, he's in California, so it's a big ask for him. For me, I'm coming from Canada. You're coming from Denver. It's much of a muchness.
Right. We're actually going to Baltimore in February as a sort of vacation.
It's an improvement.
Yeah, from our snowy wonderlands. So.
But, on the weather point, you know, everyone was just asking me, oh, how lovely to be in California for 2 weeks, blah, 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 you know, because I was out there for quite a while with the ESAR conference. And I said, look, California is lovely, but I was inside at the conference, as Austin said, it's inside, it's busy. You don't get outside a lot. So it doesn't, where location is less relevant in terms of that. It's just cost of airfare, I guess.
Right. Yeah, totally. And, you know, for a lot of East Coast people, because this, you know, that the last one was a West Coast conference and you had a lot more people where it was a lot easier to get there. But this is the East Coast conference. And for a lot of people that are on the East Coast, you know, Baltimore is pretty easy to fly into and should be pretty accessible. So I'm expecting to see a lot of people there. And it's definitely going to be like the big conference of the year.
It's actually, biggest conference of 2017. And it'll be the biggest conference until we have UAC now, like, because that'll after NCGR February 2017. There's some of the smaller regional conferences like NORWAC in Seattle will still happen in May, and GLAC and SOTA will still happen. But the next big one after NCGR won't be till May 2018.
Right. So this is the last big hurrah before UAC 2018.
Exactly.
Cool. Well, I hope to see some people there. Why don't we get on to the forecast for this month?
Yes.
So there's a few major things. I mean, it's not like a crazy month like September in terms of like eclipses and major outer planet ingresses and things like that. But we otherwise, there's a few sort of major alignments this month that are probably worth highlighting, right?
Yes.
So I'm looking at my Planet Watcher 2016 calendar, and the three that stand out, there's two or three that stand out the most to me. I mean, one of them, I think you've already mentioned, Kelly, is the Jupiter-Pluto square. But then also Neptune stations direct on the 19th of November. And we've got an ingress of Mars into Aquarius. So Mars is finally really fully picking up steam again and is starting to move through the signs at like a normal pace again, I think, right? Of like a month per sign or something.
Yes, that is correct.
More like 5-6 weeks.
I think.
Yeah, it looks like it stays there in Aquarius until October or till December 19th. So you're right, like 5 or 6 weeks, Austin. So what do you guys think about the alignments for November. Is the Jupiter-Pluto thing square the main thing for you guys, or the main signature?
I would say that that is our entry point into something we're going to be doing for a while that does center on Jupiter. Because, you know, part of the way I've been looking at Jupiter and Libra, Jupiter and Libra wants the world to be a better place. It wants harmony. It wants peace. It wants peace accords. And it can want that, but it's one planet. And if we look at the history of Jupiter's time in Libra, we see people trying to move towards that and sometimes achieving it, but a lot of times, you know, those peace accords getting frustrated or shot down or delayed. And so once we get into mid-November, we see Jupiter in Libra in a tight square with Pluto in Capricorn, right? And so if Pluto doesn't want the same peace that Jupiter does, then we have the potential for conflict and interference. In addition to that, it won't happen this month, but after Jupiter clears that square to Pluto, it'll be moving into an opposition with Uranus in Aries. And Uranus in Aries is a lot of things, but mellow and peaceful is not one of them. And so it's actually going to be relatively close to Jupiter's retrograde station Jupiter's going to station retrograde pretty close to that opposition to Uranus and then come back into the square with Pluto and then later next year do both of those again. And so this is really like, you know, this is the beginning of these sort of challenges to Jupiter and Libra. Like, can we bring our lives into balance, into greater balance, into more rooted and flexible balance? And, you know, and if we want to do so, we have to, this is the minefield or the obstacle course. It's sort of activating. It's not quite the Uranus Pluto square with the intensity that we had it in like 2012 to 15. But it, you know, it is a planet that wants peace and coherence, dealing with two rather discordant bodies by hard aspect. And so I would say that, you know, we get an introduction to this, a very thorough introduction to that theme in this November.
And just to add to that, Austin, because I think you make a really good point. This is like the start of the next collection of outer planetary configurations, which is going to run all the way through until August, September of 2017, I think.
Yeah.
The Jupiter-Pluto square is exact on November 24th, 2016. Around 16 degrees of Libra and Capricorn. It is a big energy. The interpretive word for squares I always think of is adjustment. You know, these idea of, and certainly with Jupiter, Pluto, large but different forces locking heads or having to accommodate each other when they really don't want to. And November 24th, that's Thanksgiving for you guys in the States.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I just thought it was really interesting. The biggest aspect of the month is kind of kicking in on arguably the most sort of intense time for a lot of people, I guess, you know, with that celebration.
Right. Oh, and it actually, there's a, right around the time it goes exact, shortly after that, there's a moon Jupiter conjunction right there at like 15 degrees of Libra. And Venus is actually also about to exactly conjoin Pluto on November 24th at 15 degrees of Capricorn. So there's like this weird alignment of like inner planets that sort of complements and sets it off right at the same time.
Yeah.
And so that's something, you know, just speaking of the moon, that's going to be something to look at as a trigger, you know, a couple times every month for the next several, is basically like, let's say 15 to 22 cardinal when the moon's there, which it is four times a month. It's going to trigger that Jupiter-Pluto-Uranus T-square, which is right now for this month, it's mostly going to be Jupiter-Pluto. But really, you know, it's a three-part contest or argument or negotiation. And so, you know, one thing that means is every time the moon is in those degrees of Cancer, we get a grand cross, a cardinal cross of different degrees of intensity. And so we get our first one of those this month. Basically, I guess it would start on the evening of November 17th and we'd still be, which is a Thursday, and then we'd wake up into the end. Yeah, it's the evening, let's just say evening of November 17th, which is a Thursday. And so we have that action, that cardinal cross action. And as we learned during the first half of this decade, cardinal tension makes stuff happen. Right. You know, things happen, good, bad, and other. It's not, it rarely manifests simply on the imaginal level. Pieces move. The pieces on the board move.
There will be corresponding real world events or action taken. I mean, cardinal signs just want things to move or progress, don't they?
Well, yeah, progress and move are, I think maybe from the perspective of cardinal signs, it's progress.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I don't know. Cardinal signs are often very, I find, goal oriented, or they have a specific target that they're looking for.
Totally.
So, yeah. So it's like there's a specific thing that's coming up that needs attention, but to get there or to achieve it, you know, you might have to adjust how you thought you would get there.
And I thought it was interesting also that you mentioned, Austin, that this is like the first of a series of these contacts between the moon and Pluto, these squares. So sort of like we had over the past year, the Saturn-Neptune squares, which first went exact last November, and then we had another one in June, and then we had the third and final one in August. This is the first in a series of those hard aspects with Pluto. So it's sort of like setting off a sequence that's going to play out over the course of the next year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm looking up some of the dates on those, and it's like, so the first one is November 24th. That's the first exact Jupiter-Pluto square. Then it looks like we've got another one that goes exact March 30th. So connecting events between late November and late March. And then when's the final one? The final one is sometime
I think it's August or September. Hang on.
It looks like
the
August.
Jupiter square Pluto is early August 2017.
Yeah, August 4th, it looks like. It goes exact at 17 Libra, 17 Capricorn. So that's going to be like a whole interesting dynamic in terms of, you know, sometimes when we get into astrology or you first learn transits, it's so much oriented around like the exact aspect going exact. And sometimes you assume that there's going to be an exact event that takes place. But in reality, sometimes it's more like a series or a sequence of events that plays out over an extended period of time. If those two planets, you know, repeat that aspect over a period of like a year like this one. So thinking about it more in like a long-term context like that is probably helpful.
Yeah, well, and a lot of times the meaning of the first event is only revealed by the other events, right? You know, it's like if you read like the first chapter of a book, there's something that might happen that may or may not be a big deal to the characters in that first chapter, but it might be revealed at the end, you know, when you get to the conclusion that there were actually some very key things that happened there. You just didn't realize it at the time.
Right, totally. Yeah, and often it can be very subtle like that in terms of, you know, something has happened. And that's actually one of the annoying things about astrological research. And I've brought this up like several times in the podcast, but it's still a recurring theme where sometimes you will have a major alignment like that and something important will happen that will end up being relevant to you. But sometimes you just don't know about it or you don't realize the significance of that yet. I mean, sometimes that can be positive, like, you know, you meet somebody one day in a coffee shop or that, you know, you start working with on someday, but you don't really see that as significant at the time. But then later, if you like end up getting married to that person, you might still think back to that date at some point in the future and realize its significance and realize how you totally didn't realize at the time how that one day would sort of change the rest of your life.
Yeah, that's a great example.
Yeah, so that's interesting. And then, so they, you know, it's also interesting how, I mean, we've also gone over this before in the past, but just the fact that even though Jupiter and or Uranus and Pluto are now getting a lot of space from each other, or getting a decent amount of space from each other, we still have like other outer planets and inner planets that keep periodically coming in and then lining up with those two and almost sort of like completing the square, or, you know, like the medieval astrologers say, like transferring the light between those two
carrying planets. The light. I was just thinking of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting in that way how sometimes that can extend and draw out some of those longer term transits that we would sometimes, you know, consider to either no longer be active or no longer be at their height. But then in fact, when you get a planet like Jupiter or Saturn or something coming in and then just repeatedly sort of pinging both of them, in this instance, through an opposition and a square over the course of the next year, you sort of realize that that square between Uranus and Pluto isn't really over at all yet. At least not as far as that configuration with Jupiter is concerned.
Yeah, well, and you know, and Jupiter basically squares Pluto, opposes Uranus, stations retrograde, opposes Uranus, squares Pluto, stations direct, squares Pluto, and then opposes Uranus. You know, nice. It's literally yes. going back and forth, weaving them back together.
Right.
So weaving them, yeah. It's a nice way of putting it.
Definitely. So what are the dates on the Uranus hard aspects then? Does it either of you have those?
Oh, yeah. Jupiter is going to oppose Uranus. The first hit is 20, Aries 20 Libra, and that's going to be in the last 10 days of December 2016. Then we'll have second hit. It looks like it's going to be 22, Aries Libra. And I think the exact hit will be early March of 2017. And then the third and final Jupiter-Uranus opposition will be 27, Aries Libra, and that's at the end of September 2017. Okay. The only thing I would add in there is that in addition to Jupiter dancing with Uranus and Pluto, Jupiter is also forming this on-again, off-again sextile with Saturn in Sag.
Mm-hmm.
The first hit is December, so we'll probably touch on it more next month, but that does, and that's a really juicy sextile because there's a lot of positive reception between Jupiter and Saturn. You know, Jupiter in Libra, the sign of Saturn's exaltation, versus Saturn in Sag, which is the sign of Jupiter's rulership. So that sextile, I don't know that it's going to change the Jupiter-Uranus-Pluto dynamic, but it does add a different element, I guess.
Well, I think that having a pleasantly received aspect with Saturn gives Jupiter in Libra and Jupiter in Libra's significations and priorities an ability to stabilize and concretize and to sort of hold position.
Yeah.
That's not otherwise suggested by Jupiter in an air sign, right? Which could literally just blow away.
Totally. Yeah. And I think, you know, you've used two words, Austin, there with Saturn that I always use, which is the stabilize and concretize. You know, Saturn will make real. And the other extension of those concepts is that, you know, the idea of something being made manifest, it becomes concrete, becomes tangible. So there's something very helpful for Jupiter about that. And probably helpful for Saturn too, but I kind of really like that sextile coming up.
Oh yeah, yeah. That it's a saving grace for sure.
Totally. And it's going to be very strong, through December, and into early January. Saturn and Jupiter are almost moving, I guess, close to the same speed because it keeps activating. So very close, juicy.
Yeah. And it's amazing in terms of some of the electional charts for this time period as well, because really the best, electional charts, especially in November, take advantage of that sextile, and either make Saturn the ruler of the ascendant because it's being sextiled by, Jupiter. And that's basically the best charts during this period. Or you get like a Sagittarius rising chart, which while it puts Saturn in the first house, it puts Jupiter as the ruler of the ascendant and it makes Jupiter closely sextile that to that Saturn in the first house, which, seriously mitigates it and makes it not.
And Jupiter's in the 11th too, making those lovely favorable configurations, which is just such a good house for Jupiter.
Yeah. And that's the best thing is basically during this entire period with, Saturn and Sagittarius, especially later this year in November, you can get, a ruler of the ascendant in the 11th house chart if you use either Saturn as the ruler of the ascendant with Aquarius rising, or if you use Sagittarius rising with Jupiter in Libra, either way, you get the ruler of the ascendant in the 11th, which is just an excellent placement for the ruler of the ascendant as just a general sort of rule for electional astrology.
Oh, yeah. And if you do the Aquarius rising, you've got Saturn in Sag in the 11th, but you also then have Jupiter in Libra in the 9th. So, yeah, that's really nice. I hadn't even thought about it in that context. Good work, yeah. Chris.
Well, yeah, and I'll take a little bit of credit, but part of that's Lisa and her excellent electional charts for this month, the first of which takes place on November 1st. So, and that actually does take advantage of the Aquarius rising. So November 1st, set it for about 2:10 or somewhere around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I should state, because I don't put this in, and people always ask me questions, but this is using local time. So you want to set it for about 2 o'clock in the afternoon in your location. You don't need to add or subtract hours in the time zone, because all what you're just shooting for is for it to be about mid Aquarius rising. And that's what's important in your location. So if you do that, you have Aquarius rising in your location, then Saturn becomes the ruler of the ascendant in this chart on November 1st. Saturn is in the 11th house, which is a good house. It's in a day chart because the sun is up above the horizon. So Saturn is of the sect in favor, and thus it's going to act very positively or very constructively. It's with Venus. It's actually in a separating conjunction with Venus. The moon is also in Sagittarius in the 11th house. And Saturn has this pretty close sextile with Jupiter, which is its domicile lord, since Saturn is in Sagittarius and at 14 degrees of that sign, while Jupiter is at 11 degrees of Libra in the 9th house and applying to a sextile with Saturn with reception. And there's no hard aspect with Mars or anything like that. Saturn is still separating from and is still getting away from that square with Neptune, but that's not otherwise hugely problematic in this context. And yeah, it's a pretty strong chart, both for the ruler of the ascendant as well as for the moon, which is in early Sagittarius and applying to primarily to a sextile with Jupiter in Libra. So it's a pretty good chart right away there on November 1st. There's a similar chart about a week later on November 6th, also at about, this one's at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, again with Aquarius rising, Saturn basically in the same position in the 11th house, sextile Jupiter. But in this chart, the moon has now moved into Aquarius in the first house, and it's applying to a trine with Jupiter in Libra in the 9th. So again, very strong ruler of the ascendant and very strong moon placement. Definitely emphasizing the 11th house and the 9th house, which would be good for, friends, groups, alliances in terms of the 11th house, but also 9th house topics like learning, potentially travel, other exchanges in terms of education, and things like that. So it's a pretty good 11th house and 9th house topic. And one of the things that's interesting about all these 11th house charts in November is this sort of broader meaning of the 11th house that I've been researching lately, which it comes up in modern astrology, but I'm surprised at how far back it goes in the tradition about 2000 years, where they always associated the 11th house with this the concept of hope or the concept of wishes or things that one wants to bring into their life or wants to achieve, or something that a person sort of aspires towards. And I think that's such an interesting, it's such an abstract concept to go back that far in the astrological tradition, where it almost sounds sort of psychological in some sense, but you can find it, that attribution to the 11th house already in a text in the first century BC.
I think, yes, when I was researching my talk on the 11th house for NORWAC earlier this year, I looked into that because I agree with you, Chris. I was like, this almost seems modern psychological, but it's a very old idea. And I had read somewhere it has to do with the planet moving up towards the midheaven.
Right.
And so it's got that idea of this planet is rising or striving to reach the top or, reach the peak. And that idea of it represents what you wish for, what you hope will come into manifestation.
Yeah, exactly.
It's aspirational, physically.
Aspirational. That's a great word, Austin.
Yeah, and that's a great example of just how some of the house meanings are just derived from very basic astronomical phenomena in terms of looking at what the astronomical phenomena is and what it's doing sort of physically or observationally, and then interpreting that in a symbolic context, that planets in the 11th house are literally rising up towards and moving up towards the very pinnacle or the very top of the chart, and therefore it sort of represents the person rising upwards or striving upwards, or what the person sort of aspires to achieve in some broader context, in the chart in terms of that house placement.
Yeah, it does. It has a long lineage, I guess, of having such a positive. It's hopeful, but also that idea then to flip it around a bit. I think when I was doing my Hori training, the idea that, you know, the 10th house represents the king and the 11th house is like the second house of the 10th. So it's like the support that can come to you from people on high. And so you get this sort of very positive sense of things coming your way that maybe you've earned, but they're that bonus or that gift, that like manna raining down from heaven, I guess. So for a number of different reasons, different symbolic perspectives, it does have this really, optimistic attribute, I guess.
Okay. Yeah. I'd like to offer something that is not nearly as hopeful, but is very interesting.
How surprising. So
earlier on the 6th, actually really early in the morning, we have kind of a rare and interesting thing. We have the moon conjoining Mars in Mars's single degree of exaltation. And so for those of you who are interested in this, this older doctrine, that although, you know, Mars is exalted in Capricorn, that it has one particular degree, you know, if you like studying those degrees like I do, that's kind of a rare opportunity, you know, to pay attention. Like we don't get Mars in its degree of exaltation, but every 2 years, and we certainly don't get the moon in exactly that same degree very often. And so that's interesting. It's an interesting election. It's interesting to tie that into, a variety of elections or works, or if you're coming at it from a traditional planetary magic point of view, that's a very interesting moment for Mars.
Yeah, definitely. And like you said, it's rare that you get a lineup like that, not just of the planet at its exaltation degree, but really being emphasized by having like a luminary there at the same time with the planet.
Yeah, it's sort of going to be like once every, I want to say like 50 years or something, right? Because you have Mars will be in that degree for maybe a day and a half, every 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a day and a half of planetary motion for the moon is maybe 18 degrees on average, maybe about more like 20 degrees on average. So that just doesn't happen very often. So if that interests you, you know, take a look at early morning on November 2016, November 6th, 2016.
Yeah. And then, let's see, the one other chart I wanted to mention really quickly just to get the three main electional charts for the month out of the way, it takes place on November 15th at about 9 o'clock in the morning with Sagittarius rising. So this is the other like good charts this month, in the month of November, aside from the Aquarius rising charts, which are just amazing, are the Sagittarius rising charts, where in this one on November 15th, you have Sag rising, Jupiter is in Libra in the 11th whole sign house. So again, it's another 11th house focused chart. And then it's applying to that sextile with Saturn, which is in Sagittarius in the first whole sign house, along with Mercury. So it is Saturn in the first house, which sometimes, you know, you might want to avoid, but if you're going to get Saturn in the first house, then this is potentially one of the best possible placements that you can have it in, because it's a day chart. It has a very close aspect with a benefic Jupiter. It has reception with Jupiter, which is also going to mitigate and make Saturn more positive. It's not otherwise afflicted by Mars or anything else. So it's extremely well placed in terms of Saturn in the first house. The ruler of the ascendant itself is doing well in the 11th, and then we have the moon in Gemini in the 7th, applying to a nice, tight trine with Jupiter. So all around, again, it's very similar themes in terms of focusing on the 11th house again, which you might interpret as like friends or alliances or groups or things like that. But it could also be helpful for more broader or long-term sort of planning things in terms of achieving one's hopes and aspirations. And with Saturn in the first house, there's this broader theme that's probably useful in terms of, putting in the hard work that's necessary to achieve some of those things, because you've got the most positive aspects of Saturn sort of highlighted in this chart. So those are my three primary elections for this month. And I think those are the ones I would really focus on. If anybody's looking for good electional charts in November, is the Sagittarius rising charts and the Aquarius rising charts.
Yeah, those are good charts. I like the, I like that you're using that mutual reception.
Yeah, yes. Just due to the Saturn being in the domicile of Jupiter and then Jupiter being in the exaltation.
Yeah.
Saturn. Right.
You know, so something that we haven't talked about yet that's not momentous with historical implications, but is worth noting, is that we get three planets changing signs during the second week in November.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mars leaves Aquarius on the 8th. And then on the 11th, we get Venus going into Capricorn. And then early on the 12th, we get Mercury going into Sagittarius. So, I mean, that's a pretty big and quick change in the lineup. And so, you know, what that means is that things are going to feel really different during the first third and the remaining two thirds of November.
Yeah, totally. That's a pretty big shift in terms of all of those ingresses taking place literally in the same half of a week or in the same 3 or 4 day period. Like you said, Mars going into Aquarius, Venus into Capricorn, and Mercury into Sagittarius.
Yeah, it's quite a lot. And then just a couple of days after that, we do have the big full moon for November in Taurus.
Mm-hmm.
On the 14th, I think it's 14th in the, you know, in Canada and the US, and it'll probably be early on the 15th down in Australia. So just in that week leading up to the full moon, there's definitely a lot shifting. And it'll be nice to have Mars, not that Mars in Capricorn necessarily has been bad, but I don't know. Mars has also been out of bounds for a chunk of that time.
Well, and when Mars is, you have this issue with malefics, right? Like when malefics are in signs that they're really happy in, that doesn't necessarily mean that we, the humans, will be happy. You know, like there are issues with a really strong Mars, you know,
mm-hmm.
Mars getting to do, you know, its thing, relatively unimpeded, can be a real issue. I kind of like Mars in Aquarius as a transit because mm-hmm. I find that Mars almost disappears in Aquarius. Like there'll be like, what I generally see is there's like some like kind of background peevishness, especially when people start talking about ideas, a lot of times they'll kind of cut into each other, but it's not like this, you know, it's not Mars as like a tank and screaming fighter jets. It's just this sort of like background, I kind of hate this, sort of martial vibe.
But I don't care enough to do anything because it's Aquarius.
Yeah.
So aloof.
Yeah. And again, it just seems like it's not even there half the time. Which, after the extremely martial year that we've been having, is just fine with me. It's just fine.
Just fine.
Right. Coming out of that retrograde, it's interesting being in a period in which Mars isn't as closely tied into any other major sort of outer planet or any inner planet configurations, at least not through hard aspects for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
That's going to be nice.
You know, speaking of that Mars retrograde, what's interesting about our big beautiful full moon in Taurus on the 14th, early on the 14th.
Oh yeah, the degree.
Yeah, it's 22 Taurus, 22 Scorpio, and it's 22 Scorpio is exactly where Mars stationed direct in June, and 22 Taurus is exactly where Mercury stationed retrograde in May. And so this is, you know, this full moon is a revisiting of what were really critical degrees for this year's events. But I would say it's a much gentler return to the same issues and the same spaces.
Yes. I have to say I'm very pro the Taurus full moon. Just in general, I love that the moon is in such a great phase. Well, the full moon is, you know, such a full, juicy, functional, I don't know, big phase for the moon, obviously. But in her exaltation, it's one of my favorite full moons each year.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. And I like that word again, Austin, the stabilizing energy, which I think Taurus of all the earth signs can just do so well, but in a really juicy, nourishing way.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Did you just say you really like it too? I can't believe we agree on something here.
No, of course. Dude, it's great. I mean, because, you know, every fall planets go through Scorpio, and I like the sort of descent into madness in the underworld that that brings. But a little bit of like a little, like that big bright note of stabilization in the middle of, you know, in the middle of that season is always a really, pleasant counterpoint.
Yes.
By the way, the sun and sun and Scorpio doesn't mean that there's a descent into madness. I'm just being
to clarify,
giving myself poetic license, and that doesn't mean something bad to me. I kind of like that.
I like everything that you guys have said about this, just because, and the return to those degrees, just because that's my Mercury degree at 23 Scorpio again. And this is,
Do you want to share?
Yeah. I mean, I'm going into I finished the book early this month. It's in its final editing phase right now, with my editor, and different people are reading it and giving me feedback that I'm incorporating, but I'm moving into the layout phase at the beginning of November. So this, you know, full moon right there on my Mercury degree, which then connects back to June when Mars was stationing there, which weirdly largely just coincided with a heightened period of focusing on the book in the middle of, you know, writing all of the chapters. It seems like that full moon then might coincide with actually getting some of the first printed copies and getting the first proof copies and actually starting to get it out there.
Perfect.
Yeah. That's a great example for people to kind of take with if they do have that degree active in their chart too.
Yeah, just because it's definitely the more productive version or manifestation of that, where, you know, that period in June, which is the focal point of Mars stationing direct at 23 Scorpio on top of my Mercury, was the focal point of just me going to the coffee shop every day and writing every day for like 8 or 9 hours. And really expending a lot of energy on that writing project. And then now, almost 6 months later, we get a full moon on those degrees, and potentially bringing that what was just like this intellectual project that was all, you know, on a digital file. It's just a big Word file at this point with like 700 pages. But hopefully by the end of November, actually bringing that to completion and to manifestation with like a physical copy of the book, being in my hands for the first time around the time of that full moon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that'll be nice.
Yeah. And I've got covers. There's been a bunch of cover designs, and thanks everyone who either offered or who did send in cover designs. There's one especially by a designer named Paula that I'm going to put out there. We've down to like three main versions of it that I really like. And I'd like to put out sort of like a poll. I'll probably post in the Facebook group, in the private Facebook group for Patreon members, to vote on. I've been having some like friends vote on it sort of informally, and everybody keeps coming back with the same specific design. Everybody keeps saying they like that one the best, but I want to do a broader poll in order to see what people think in order to finalize the cover design for the book. So if you're in the Facebook group, then you should be seeing that pretty soon.
Very exciting.
All right. So we covered a lot. We covered the ingresses. We covered the full moon in Taurus. Neptune stationing direct. I mean, to me, that seems more, I know it's not like closely tied in with anything, but just still coming out of the whole Saturn-Neptune square over the past year, that seems significant to me in some ways.
And you don't even have planets at that degree, Chris.
Yeah.
Right, unlike you guys. You guys have planets all over there,
right? I'm like, are we there yet, Neptune? Like, honestly, but well,
and
slowly.
Also, it stations direct on top of the South Node.
Correct.
Same degree. There's a perfect South Node Neptune conjunction on the 17th. And then...
Oh, shit, the South Node at 9. I didn't even look at this.
Yeah.
Austin.
And then the station is on the 19th. So it's right there.
Hmm.
Yeah, so I mean, maybe a reactivation of some of those things in terms of the Saturn Neptune square. Eventually Mercury, you know, because he ingresses earlier in the month into Sagittarius, is going to catch up to square Neptune, square the nodes.
It's on the same day.
Saturn. Oh, you're right.
Mercury
is
going to square Neptune like within 24 hours of its stationing.
Okay.
Oh, la la.
And that is, of course, configured to the exact degree of our total solar eclipse in September, right? Which was
that 9 is true. That is true.
So there's secret nodal stuff happening here.
Venus will be sextile. Maybe that will be nice. Yeah. So Yeah. I'm really thinking now. You guys have got me thinking.
Yeah, well, it's been interesting seeing Mercury Neptune as like a theme this year in different ways. In addition to the Saturn Neptune, I'm sure that's most of what I'm seeing, but just, you know, that line between like what's reality and what's not reality, and that coming up, you know, most clearly, especially in politics, you know, in terms of the presidential election and sort of both sides of that sort of, always sort of accusing the other of misleading or not being realistic or distorting the truth, and different things like that seem like they've been really prominent sort of in the world in general over the past year.
Yeah. Well, and as you brought out, quite brilliantly earlier in the year, the line between, reality and virtual reality and augmented reality being scuffed very thoroughly this year. Maybe we'll have an interesting development as far as VR and AR goes around this time. And then one of the things that I've been looking at in terms of the South Node or Dragon's Tail or K2, and Neptune is I see one of the ways that I look at the South Node is having a purgative or cleansing function. Right. And I mean purgative, like you take a purgative and then you vomit everything that's gross up, right? The South Node is connected with the past, what was, undigestible, what might have poisoned you, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, it's, if you go on a meditation retreat and you try to be quiet for 2 days straight and your brain just vomits up all sorts of dumb things in the process of cleaning. And so one of the collective, manifestations of that this year with just South Node and Neptune being co-present, and then that being exaggerated and intensified with this actual perfect conjunction coming up, is I think when I think of Neptune, I think of stories. You know, people have like these storylines that they walk around inside of. You know, we always have this weird sort of narrative background to whatever we think reality is. And one of the things I expected and wrote about, I don't know, almost a year ago, was this sort of barfing up all of these toxic dreams. And there's so many toxic storylines about how about how our world is right now. And so you see these on all sorts of, you know, all across the political spectrum. Although I certainly don't have the same feelings about everything in the political spectrum, but there is this sort of like, you know, the old nightmares thing that you can see with the South Node Neptune. And so, you know, you'd be able to watch that politically. This is like a week, you know, week and a half after the election, everybody would be telling stories. And then on a personal level, you know, it might be timed, you might realize that you've been walking around with the assumption that, you know, you've been walking around with the assumption that you're kind of, you know, you're in a tragedy or you're in a horror story, or that things are necessarily going to go bad for you. Things couldn't possibly go right. And you might wake up a little bit and realize that that doesn't actually square with the facts, and that might not be your story.
That's interesting. That's
beautiful.
Yeah, that's making, I'm trying to pull up really frantically something that Patrick had mentioned to me, actually in Donald Trump's chart, which he said he pointed out was really similar to something that was in Romney's chart, that we really focused on and became like an important part of our prediction during the 2012 election, which was that he was in a foreshadowing period on election day. And then he had a loosing of the bond, 2 or 3 weeks later, which at the time we said that there was something about the election that wasn't going to be finished for Romney until 2 or 3 weeks later. And what it ended up being was like on election night when Obama won the 2012 election, he said something about reaching out to Romney to try to work together in the future. And then that actually happened. And to the extent that Romney visited the White House 2 or 3 weeks after election day, had a private meeting with Obama, and then that was really the end of it. But that was a really interesting and sort of like wild piece of our prediction that we were fascinated with how it turned out. And Patrick was pointing out to me that Trump has something very similar on election day in November. And I'm just pulling that up really quickly to confirm that I'm remembering that properly and that he was right. Yeah. Okay. So, and I was curious how close it was going to be relative to that Mercury, Neptune square and the Neptune South Node conjunction that we're talking about right now. So it looks like it's a foreshadowing period for Trump from November 6th through the 9th, 2016. And then it's connected to a loosing of the bond that takes place a few weeks later, where there's a repetition or a return to something that happened a few weeks earlier, November 27th through the 30th. So it's actually a little bit later than the period that we're talking about, but perhaps still interesting and relevant in terms of, I don't know, some of the questions that have come up recently about what happens after Election Day or what happens once the results are announced on Election Day.
Hmm.
So
it's just, it's going to be tricky, I guess, sifting fact from fiction with that Neptune South node. The other thing that comes to mind about that, not so much to do with the election, Chris, is I think it's a Vedic idea, the idea that the South node is a spiritualizing influence, that it's a point that kind of describes things that are not materially focused or not necessarily of this world, and yeah,
specifically those things which are disembodied or partially disembodied.
Yeah. And I wonder if it's sort of that idea of, you know, what does it all mean or what's the purpose of all this? And maybe that idea of people getting connected to things that have more meaning or, you know, hold significance for us as individuals that aren't, materially focused, I guess, that idea of, intangibles.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I was like the Vedic sort of take on that, because they generally just treat the nodes as sort of malefic in some sense or destabilizing, except for this like other part, this sort of spiritual component that they can bring in a more constructive manifestation, right?
Right, mm-hmm. But that's part of it. You know,
yeah.
If we're talking about the fabric of everyday life, going into a cave to meditate for 5 years is really disruptive.
Yes.
You know, that like spirit, you know, one might argue that an authentic or radical spirituality is always going to be disruptive to the rhythm of like waking up and brushing your teeth and going to work and coming home.
You know, totally.
That it is a counterpoint to the normal rhythm of things.
Right. Yes.
And but also that, you know, that can be a constructive manifestation of that. If you like, you know, go out and live like an aesthetic lifestyle, or, you know, devote yourself to meditation or something 100 hours a day. But for those that can't do that or don't want to do that or are reluctant to let go of the other sort of material comforts of life, that there's something destabilizing and something painful about that sort of loss of what they're otherwise accustomed to or what they're used to doing.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that gets said about Ketu dashas are, you know, basically a time lord, where a time lord system kind of like zodiacal releasing that a lot of Vedic astrologers use, which gives a planetary period to each of the planets and then to each of the nodes, you know, the advice that I've seen a number of times is that if you're coming into a Ketu dasha, like, it's time to get religion, because if
yes.
you go in that direction, things will go pretty well. But if you don't have a significant chunk of your life carved out for that and you try to paddle against that current, things tend to go very poorly.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. All right. Well,
so yes, you were kind of summarizing, I think, Chris, all the things that we talked about.
Yes. Well, I'm trying to think if there's any other major things. And we've talked about the Jupiter-Pluto. Eventually, we get the Sun ingress into Sagittarius on November 21st. And then finally, we get a nice new moon in Sagittarius on November 29th.
Well, so, it is square Neptune, the new moon.
Right.
It's an 8 Sag.
That's not my favorite new moon, actually.
Yeah. Tell us why, Austin.
Well, it's a little too close to Saturn for my taste,
mm-hmm.
and it's certainly a little too square to the nodal axis for my taste, and it's definitely too square Neptune for my taste.
I know we thought we were done with the Saturn-Neptune square, but that new moon could just be like one last hurrah.
Yeah. The new moon's taking place at 7 degrees of Sagittarius. So that's closely squaring Neptune at 9 Pisces and the North Node, which is by then around like 8 Virgo or so.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
And then, you know, Saturn's right there, and both the sun and the moon are on their way to Saturn.
Sure. Right. So they're both applying to Saturn, which is at 17. So they're about 10 degrees off, but otherwise we'll be quickly approaching it. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, that's actually the period that coincides with what I was talking about. In terms of Trump having the loosing of the bond between November 27th and November 30th. So it's interesting that that coincides with that new moon. And it will be interesting to see if that, you know, there's something that happens on election day that's not finished for him is what that implies until mm-hmm. about this time, November 27th through the 30th, and whether that's essentially internal, like it was with Romney in 2012, or whether it's something else, you know, who knows, because I haven't looked into it much beyond this, but it's an interesting signature to see.
Wasn't there talk about him launching Trump TV or something?
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, that sounds pretty Saturn Neptune. I don't know. I just, you know, I've pretty much only been able to bring myself to watch the Saturday Night Live versions of the debates.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Those have been great. I mean,
Kate watches the debates and tells me what I missed, and it's usually exactly what I thought would happen.
Yeah, no, the debates have been amazing, and the Saturday Night Live parodies have just been amazing this election cycle, but especially for the debates. But in terms of the Trump TV thing, I mean, that was part of the prediction at the presidential panel, is that he has this major career transition. It's a loosing of the bond on level 2 between December of 2017 and March of 2020. But that was tied into my prediction, which is, you know, for a while now, it hasn't been clear why he would be having a major career transition like a year after the election if he won. So that was one of the things that implied to me that he doesn't win, but instead about a year after, in the 2 or 3 years after the election, he sort of makes this major career transition and figures out where he wants to go from here, you know, after not becoming president, after putting all this energy into it for the past year or two. So that's what I basically talked about in my ESAR lecture. And yeah, the recording will be on my website if you want the actual details of that to see what I'm talking about, rather than just me sort of throwing that concept out here. Yeah. Well, I think that brings us to the end of November. I had one more. Lisa had actually found one more election, and she was really actually struggling, because I remember when we talked about this and looked at some different charts for late November. And one of the things is, especially when we were still writing the column for TMA, is wanting to switch it up a little bit and give different times out and some different rising signs so that there's a little bit of variety, and it's not just all, you know, here's 4 Aquarius rising charts at different points during the month, even though that's what we otherwise might recommend. So we try to switch it up with one of the later elections, which is November 24th with Cancer rising about 7 o'clock in the evening, whatever your location is. And then the moon is in Libra in the fourth house, applying to a conjunction with Jupiter. Unfortunately, that's also pretty much like right around the exact time of that Jupiter-Pluto square that we were talking about. So it's a little iffy, but if you're able to pull off like a positive manifestation of that, then the Pluto contact and the Venus-Pluto conjunction, which that is square, would add a lot of power and a lot of oomph to it, as long as you're able to sort of navigate it constructively rather than have it not work constructively or having it work destructively.
You know, one of the things I've seen consistently, at least in natal charts with Jupiter Pluto, is hidden treasure.
Yeah,
it's like,
sure.
It's hidden, you know, it's some advantage or opportunity or treasure that you don't see with the naked eye. You know, it requires a little bit of digging. And so sure, this is a square, but I don't think that totally cancels out that the meaning set for that planetary pair.
Yeah, and it's funny that you mentioned that, because this is also a very fourth house focused chart. And in a lot of the early like Hellenistic delineations of the fourth house, in Valens, for example, he talks about the fourth being associated with like literal hidden treasure. So that could also be extended more metaphorically, but that sort of repeats that theme a little bit through the emphasis of the ruler of the ascendant in the fourth with Jupiter, with Venus ruling the fourth and the moon applying to a square with it. So that's my final electional chart for November. And I think that pretty much brings us to the end of the month, because the month basically ends with that new moon in Sagittarius that we just talked about. So
correct. Yeah.
Are there any other major like alignments that we didn't get to mention that we're completely overlooking here?
I don't think so. Like the biggest aspect is the Jupiter square Pluto, which we've definitely covered. There's a lot of sextiles and trines in November. So, you know, Sun, Mercury, Venus are kind of moving through signs where they are aspecting the other planets, but not necessarily by the more dramatic oppositions or squares. So, yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily think we have to run through them all because there's a bunch of them. But, yeah, the big dynamic aspect, I guess, is the Jupiter square Pluto.
Sure. Okay, cool. Well, I think that then brings us close to the end of a more, slightly more muted episode. I'm still catching up on like sleep and emails from the conference, so I'm totally out of it.
Totally.
I don't know. Austin, you might be feeling similarly.
Oh, yeah. I've got emails and I don't have sleep.
Right. And then Kelly, you're still catching up after post-conference stuff as well.
Totally. Yeah. I think we were talking about this briefly, Chris, like when we, you know, pre-show chat. Yeah. It just takes a little while to catch up and everything always takes longer. Well, me personally and my, you know, with my Neptune fog, everything just takes a little longer than I think it's going to. So I just keep plugging away. We'll get to the end of the email list eventually.
Sure. And let's see, in terms of other things I meant to mention that I forgot to, our other sponsor month, of course, is Delphic Oracle. So for patrons on the $5 tier, the giveaway this month is one free copy of that awesome astrology software program, which is specifically designed for Hellenistic and traditional astrology. It really excels at timing techniques. It has every known Hellenistic Time Lord technique that exists, including some medieval ones. I use it in every consultation I've been doing for the past 10 years for calculating zodiac releasing periods. And most of the stuff in my zodiac releasing lecture, when you look at the periods I have in the sort of readout for that, all of that comes from Delphic Oracle. So I'm excited to be able to promote that program and give away a free copy to somebody on the $5 tier on episode 94 of the show. So in two episodes, we'll do the giveaway and announce the winners for that. Other things those ESR lectures are already up for sale. I'm selling my zodiac releasing lecture where it's like a nice, concise, last December I recorded my 18 hour zodiac releasing lecture. And this one's a little bit more approachable because it's just 75 minutes.
This is the sprint rather than the marathon.
Yeah, exactly. I've got to work on being more concise. And this was a nice challenge to take like an 18 hour lecture and condense it down into 75 minutes. But also I wanted to make it more topical and more relevant to what's going on in the world right now. So I used the birth chart. The consistent theme throughout the talk was showing how you can use zodiac releasing to time, you know, peak periods and transitions in a person's career and overall life direction. And then I kept coming back to the birth chart of Hillary Clinton and the birth chart of Donald Trump in order to show how the technique could be applied to determine the outcome of the, you know, US presidential election next month. And this is the basis of, you know, it's a large part of the basis of any predictions I've made about the election or that Patrick's made. And it was also the basis of why, even way back in 2012, in like April of 2012, when we got contacted by first a reporter from ABC News, and then eventually I went on Fox News, and they asked us, you know, do you think that Hillary Clinton's going to run for the presidency in 2016? We pulled up her zodiac releasing periods, and she's in this like huge peak period right now where the technique basically says she's at the high point of her career. We were able to say at that point, it looks like she's definitely going to be running in 2016 for the presidency. So I have the recording of that technique out, and I will link to it. Lisa also gave an amazing lecture on annual perfections and how you can use that technique to show repetitions in 12-year increments and how that can be useful in making predictions. Because basically, if you want to know if you've just had your birthday or you're coming up on your birthday and you want to know what the next year is going to be like, what you can do is look back in 12-year increments at what happened, you know, 12 years ago. then what happened in the year 12 years before that and 12 years before that. And she shows how using this technique of perfections, which repeats every 12 years, that you can identify some of the main topics and themes that will come up in a person's life and then subsequently make predictions about that. And she also ends up using the chart of Hillary Clinton and showing how if you take it back in 12-year increments, she keeps doing important things and she keeps having first, like firsts.
That was a really interesting point that Lisa made in her talk.
Yeah. So, you know, being the first student like several 12-year increments ago at her college to, you know, give the student lecture at a, like a commencement speech for her graduating class, or in 1992, which was two 12-year increments ago, she had her birthday right before the 1992 presidential election and then, you know, was in the White House suddenly for that, for the first time in that perfection year. And now we're, you know, two 12-year increments later, 24 years later, and she's about to have her birthday, what, a day or two from now, switches into another 10th house perfection year, and then we get a repetition of 1992/1993 all over again, which, you know, kind of speaks for itself. So that lecture is up on Lisa's website. I'll link to it in the description page for this episode. Kelly, you've got your two NORWAC lectures up, but you're also, I believe you wanted to do a sort of discount for listeners of the show, right?
Yes, I wanted to offer listeners a 10% off coupon code if they are interested in a chart consult. The only catch is you have to get in touch before the 7th of November, which will give everyone probably a solid 10 days from when the show is first released. The coupon code is podcast, and you can just pop onto my website and pop through your order and use that code, and it will automatically give you 10% off either a 60 or a 90-minute consult. Yeah, just as a thank you. It was so lovely to meet so many people at the recent ESAR conference, so I just wanted to show a little thanks for that.
Awesome. Good. And people can find out about that. I'll put a link to it on the description page for this episode, and then they can also go to your website, which is kellysurtees.com, right?
Correct. Yes. Okay. Yes.
And what do you have going on, Austin?
Well, on the 12th of November, Saturday the 12th, I'm going to be beginning a month-long class on sort of synthesizing all the different fundamentals of astrology, looking at charts and saying, okay, so I know about dignity and houses and signs and aspects and synodic cycles. So what is that? You know, how do you do that all together, right? You know, it's instead of learning how to play the drums or the piccolo, it's like getting the whole orchestra to work together and seeing how all those different techniques describe different parts of a person's life. So it's the final unit in my 7-month fundamentals of astrology class. But people who've already, you know, who are already sort of in the middle of learning astrology, but who haven't necessarily taken classes from me, are free to drop in. Well, it's not free, but but you're, you know, it's designed to be modular. So if that sounds like a good class for you, you can sign up for just that. You don't have to do the whole course. And then as of today, so certainly by the time this is out, I finally got the 8-week class on the decans that I taught last year, edited and available for purchase. And so that's if you, got my book but hate reading, but want to learn about the decans anyway, you know, it's about 15 hours of me going through every decan. If you like the book and would like more, it's also good for that.
Nice.
But it's, you know, it's all the decans you can handle.
Love it.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
I forgot to mention one thing, Chris.
Sure.
My next online class starts on November 8th. It's a specialist class over a 5-week period for more intermediate and advanced students. So if anyone's interested, they can just hit me up through the website. I forgot to mention that. But Austin, I can't speak highly enough about your book, your Deccans book. So that recording program that you did on all of them would be amazing.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, I'm glad you got that edited and got that up, because that's a great resource.
Yeah, I've been meaning to do that for a long time, and it's just one of those, you know, one of those projects that keeps getting pushed to the back of the list, but it's finally done, it's cleaned up, it's beautiful, or is as beautiful as it's going to get.
Right, and it's nice because with something like that, you can speak as long as you want about, you know, that topic. Whereas with the book, you're sort of limited to, you know, well, I mean, theoretically, you should limit it to not doing what I did, writing like a 700 page book about like every
detail.
Hey, look,
if it works for Richard Tanis, it can work for you too.
Right. We'll see. We'll see.
Yeah. Text is less digressive than speech.
Right. Yeah, that's one of the things I really appreciate about speech and about doing these podcasts. And that's why they're so wordy most of the time, is because you can get more in and you can also like qualify statements a little bit more and explore things more sometimes when necessary, even if that sometimes leads to more of a, like a, not directionless, but or rambling, but maybe meandering, like more meandering than it might in like a written text or something like that.
Yeah, well, but you know, both mediums have their own advantages and disadvantages.
Definitely. All right, awesome. Well, I think that brings us to the end of this episode. So, check out, you know, everything will be on the description page for this episode. If you want to be entered into the drawing, then just become a patron on the $5 or $10 tier, and you could win a pass to this awesome conference in February, or you could win a copy of this awesome astrology program. Thanks everyone for supporting us through Patreon. It makes a huge difference and has ensured that I've continued to do the show and put out episodes as much as I can, even despite being so focused on the book over the past year. And I'm actually really super excited to be done with the book soon, because then I can get back to doing 4 episodes a month regularly and continuing to expand and improve the show in a way that I sort of couldn't as much as I wanted to this year. So, I'll be looking forward to that, and yeah, looking forward to doing more episodes with you two.
Excellent.
Yeah, I look forward to it every month.
Cool. All right. Well, I guess let's sign off then. So thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.
All right. Take her easy, everybody.
Bye for now.